I really believe that coming out of the pandemic, there has been a greater openness to look at learning more broadly and more authentically, because we've seen what happened to the mental health of kids. We know that we're losing kids and we're losing teachers, and the consequence of not looking at learning differently is greater than the cost of making change.
Welcome to Learning Unboxed, a conversation about teaching, learning, and the future of work. I'm your host and chief goddess of the PASS Foundation, Annalise Corbin. We know the current model for education is obsolete. It was designed to create fleets of assembly line workers, not the thinkers and problem solvers needed today. We've seen the innovations that are possible within education, and it's our goal to leave the box behind and reimagine what education can look like in your own backyard. Welcome to today's episode of Learning Unboxed. As always, I'm excited to talk with another great set of innovators in the transformative education space. And today, we are going to be talking about one of my favorite subjects, authentic learning, as a positive disruptor in the way we think about education generally, and more specifically about school. And what is school and what the heck are we doing this for? And we have two incredible ladies that are joining us today for this conversation. We have Ellen Erlinger and Kathy Meyer, who are the co-directors of professional learning at the Partnerships for Authentic Learning and Leadership. So Ellen and Kathy, welcome to Learning Unboxed.
Thank you.
Thanks, Annalise.
I am super excited, as I said, and so let's set a little bit of context for our listeners as we get started. Partnerships for Authentic Learning and Leadership help educators make learning irresistible, and I've always loved that as your tagline, because it just gives me great joy. Learning should, in fact, be irresistible, and Kathy and Ellen work with teachers, administrators, and organizations on transformation that readies students for success in the real world. Nothing is more rewarding than for them to help fellow educators see the bigger picture where school meets life. So ladies, let's start with the 100,000 foot view, and I'm going to toss this to either one of you who can provide us with sort of the bigger 100,000 sort of foot view of why this organization came to be, because it's actually been around in various sort of iterations or capacities for a number of years. So let's start there.
This work has been a natural continuation of work that we did when we were with our respective school districts. Kathy and I both wore a lot of hats, including service learning, career development, counseling, health services, a variety of things, but all devoted to the well-being of kids and in one way or another, a commitment to promote deeper learning. And in wearing all of those hats, when we were ready to retire, we received a lot of encouragement to continue what we were doing, particularly with service learning and other forms of authentic instruction. For us, it was really a joy and a mission to keep that work going, because it was not only the work that we had witnessed deeply affecting young people, but also teachers. We found that when we were able to engage teachers in doing things with their kids that were more authentic and involved the weaving together of academic learning, but also social-emotional learning and outreach to the community, that's where the magic was, and that was the work we chose to continue.
Go ahead, Kathy.
I was just going to add to that. So this started really back in 1996 with Joe Carana, was a professor at Ohio State and really a mentor to both Ellen and myself. And so over the years, it was a nonprofit organization that he started with the state school superintendent in Rhode Island. And so we started to do our work in that nonprofit when those principals had kind of aged out of the organization, we rebranded. And partly we rebranded because we had primarily focused on the work of teachers in many years. And so it was always easy to get, when you got teachers in the room, they wanted to do this work. It spoke to their teacher heart. It made them happy. They saw such progress with their kids. But if they went back to a school that leadership didn't make decisions in a way that supported this type of instruction, it was not sustainable. So when we rebranded the organization, it was intentional to include authentic leadership as a part of it. And so now work also with our executive director, Emmy Beeson, who works more closely with administrators than we do, because most of our work is with teachers. And so it's been a nice way to look at this as more sustainable and long-lasting, because decisions are being made that help to support this kind of innovation.
Yeah, and that's absolutely key. So thank you very much, Kathy, for adding that in, because what, you know, we collectively know the work that the two of you do and your organization as well, certainly as PASS Foundation, we have seen that exact same thing, right? Mm-hmm. We're talking about systems change. It can't, yes. It's great when you get really enthusiastic individuals or groups of individuals that are on the ground at that implementation phase, and that's wonderful, and magic can in fact happen even under those scenarios. But the reality is, without that full systems in alignment and support, it will be a moment of greatness, yes, rather than eons of opportunity. And I think, mm-hmm, that's one of those really sort of key differences. So I appreciate you making a point to share that with us. You know, Ellen, I want to make sure that our listeners have a solid understanding before we continue this conversation. What do we mean in the context of the three of us having this conversation when we use the phrase authentic learning? Because it can be a lot of things, and it can certainly be a lot of things to a lot of people. But one of the things I appreciate about the work that you all do is that you have really sort of narrowed in on it. You allow it to be customized and broad, but you mean something very specific when you use this phrase. So what is that?
We really use that phrase to describe strategies that are designed to make intentional connections for kids between their academic experience in school and the world outside of school. And mm-hmm, particularly, we want teachers and leaders to empower kids with experiences that allow them to have impact in the world right now. And so that is a part of why our history in service learning is particularly important, because it engages kids in having meaningful impact in the mm-hmm, the community or in the world in the present tense. For us, authentic learning is about those experiences to create products and services for authentic audiences and authentic clients. It's about developing skills that are going to be very much needed, not just now for learning, but later for effectiveness in the workspace. We help teachers accomplish authentic learning through the skills they intentionally develop in kids and the experiences they intentionally provide.
That's the reason we all get along so well, right?
Yeah.
Because we so desperately believe in exactly what you were talking about. That's awesome. Kathy, I know that as the two of you have been down this journey, you've actually seen some really remarkable examples. And as we all know, mm-hmm, teachers, all humans by nature, right? Not just educators, but what we love tangible examples. We really really need to dig in and understand. Mm-hmm. So could you give us an example or two of some of these authentic experiences that you feel like really highlight? And I know you have many and it's hard to narrow it down, but just to help folks understand sort of the breadth and depth of what we're talking about, because often I think what happens is we hear these terms and then we run to the thing that we've most locally seen or we think might fit that. And oftentimes we are not thinking big enough or broadly enough.
I appreciate the question. Ellen's probably laughing right now because I love to tell stories. And so you've given me the permission to do that.
I did.
So I think a couple of things, examples that I would give, and partly because what we've tried over the last several years, Ellen's mentioned, we started in service learning. I mean, it speaks to everybody's heart. But then you go in a room, and like if we were working with your teachers, they go, well, we do STEM.
Right.
So I can't do service learning.
Right.
Or I do design thinking, so I can't do STEM.
I know, we're all chuckling about this, right? Because yes, we've all experienced that. And the answer is, oh, but you already are, or you do, or you can. Take your pick, right?
Right. Or make this little tweak, you know, that will. Yeah. So what we've tried to do really is wherever you are in the process, and we don't want to pull teachers apart. We want to help them make connections to what are the best practices, no matter what it is you call it. So one example I would use, and everybody's so concerned, understandably, especially since COVID, on mental health and of students and teachers, for that matter. I mean, a big reason we do this work is because we want teachers to keep teaching. And so we want them to feel joy and purpose in their work. But several years ago, we used to have two summits a year that would bring about 250 to 300 teachers and students from Central Ohio to Mid-Ohio Food Bank to talk about critical issues in the community and the world. And this was K through 12, I might add. And the little ones had great ideas. And they'd meet people, organizations in the community that were dealing with these issues and trying to make a difference. And then the thought was that they would go off then in their classrooms and continue to do this work. So we invited the Upper Arlington broadcast journalism kids to come and create a video. I'd always tried to slap a video together as the culminating thing. And so we thought, let's use some experts. And we could not have put those kids in a more high-stakes, anxiety-producing situation. You know, oftentimes when we talk about kids' mental health, our knee-jerk reaction is, oh, we got to take some of this off of them. We have to take a step back versus how can we give their work purpose and deeper meaning to what they're doing, because kids rise to the occasion. So
they do. Indeed.
They do.
Let's emphasize that. You know, the kids will go where we set the bar.
That's right. And it's not doing more work, but
right.
it's doing more purposeful work
yep.
that can be more rigorous than anything we ever did. So we set up the situation they had. They couldn't interview people at the summit until lunchtime. And then we were ending like at 2:30. So they had like 2 hours to put together this video. And as kind of a celebration and culmination of the day. And I watched the kids. The teacher was absolutely a facilitator. She wasn't telling them what to do. She was she had given them skills and knowledge. And then they transferred that to a new situation, which is the deep learning part of that. And so I watched them. I wish I'd videotaped them because that was really the story. And they were problem solving. They were working hard. And the whole while they were laughing and enjoying what they did. So then we showed this video at the end, and it was, I mean, we might have paid a professional organization $10,000 for. It was that good. It was great. And so if I had been grading them, they certainly would have gotten an A. And after we showed it, two of the kids, high school kids, came up to me and said, "Can we have that video back? There's a few things we want to change and
love
improve
it.
On it."
Love it.
And
love
so
it.
The impact on positive mental health yeah. in a rigorous, high stakes situation was so obvious. And it was, I think that was the point that was kind of that aha moment for me, that though we complain about kids only caring about grades, it's because that's all the options we give them most of the time. And it was the difference between an extrinsic reward, like an A or an award, an intrinsic reward that they cared enough about this project to want to make it even better. So that, and you know, we've got examples of kindergartners and first graders that display the same thing. It's the same, you know, when you look at it, what was it about the situation that made it work? It's not the actual activity, but it's the experiences that you're giving kids to collaborate, to problem solve, to use their knowledge to make a difference. And I don't care if they're in kindergarten or they're AP calculus kids.
Yeah.
You get the same results.
Yeah, you absolutely do. And I really appreciate that because we've seen that so many times. You know, and it's really also interesting because one of the things that Ellen had mentioned earlier, and I want to circle back with this just a little bit, is that, you know, one of the things about authentic learning is it has great appeal to students because students care so much about what's going on. And I think we really, 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 really see this in our Gen Zs and our alphas. And we do see this as our generational changes and shifts start to happen. But we know that this group of individuals, really, they care about the environment. They care about mental health. They care about violence and community. The list is really long of the things that they feel like they want to roll up their sleeves and do something about. But they also want to have their voice and choice in that sort of autonomy that comes with a growing maturity of ascending through those teenage years into adulthood. They crave those things too. So Ellen, when you start to work with schools or teachers around crafting authentic learning and, quite frankly, authentic leadership too, ultimately as a part of that systems change, how do you help folks, you know, on the ground with the students understand that you can, in fact, have authentic experiences and also honor that voice and choice component that's so incredibly important right now, right? Back to the mental health sort of issues. These things are all hand in hand. So how do you coach that?
You know, often when we're working with teachers over a period of time, we begin by showing them lots and lots of examples to reinforce that indeed this can be done. It's been done time after time by teachers just like you, with kids just like yours. And I think there is a series of aha moments that teachers have as they watch other teachers and other kids do amazing things that they care about on a very deep level. And then we can, after exposing them to the examples, step back and say, you know, there are some planning models that make it easy to do stuff like this. We just have to start with a topic or a target, you know, with what you and your students have in mind. And this really becomes possible. So, I mean, I think the first question we get with brand new people is, it sounds really good, and I know that there's research to support it. And gosh, we sure like you, Kathy and Ellen, but what does it look like? Show us what this looks like so that we can begin to envision what it would look like for us and our students. So, you know, it's a lot by example. It's also, frankly, in recent years, we start with every group of teachers and administrators by doing some activities that really look at their personal mission as educators and what they envision as most important for kids, what they envision as most important in the learning environment, and the things they tell us about their best days, the things they tell us about the outcomes and strengths they want to cultivate in kids. All of those things are better nurtured through authentic learning than they are through traditional approaches. So, you know, we try to awaken their sense of mission and their teacher heart. We should try to show them lots of examples. We try to give them tools, and then we coach them along the way through a project idea whenever we're working with a population over time. If you need a different type of answer, tell me what I didn't fill in there.
No, that's perfect. But Kathy, you know, this is a great idea that Ellen has. But the reality of it is I just don't have time for this, right? I've got this test coming up. I've got to make sure these kids are ready to take that AP biology after they leave my course, that's the thing they're going to sign up for next. Or, you know, my union says I have to be out of the building. You know, school ends at 2:30 and my day ends at 2:35. No questions asked. And so how could I possibly plan for this?
Have we ever heard that, Ellen? I don't know.
Yeah.
Only about a million times, right?
I really think that was the most effective impression of that point of view that I've heard in a while. That was really very convincing.
You know, it's really interesting because you do have you've got a finite amount of time mm-hmm, when you're teaching.
We do.
And so you have to prioritize. And really, the only way that we can increase instructional time, if kids are still thinking about what it is they're learning in school after they leave the classroom, if they're transferring that knowledge into new situations. And so just to add one thing, when Ellen was talking about the best days, you know, sometimes we'll have a teacher say, well, you know, I teach upper-level math at high school. There's no way I can do this. I've got set curriculum I have to get through. And then they'll say in their best days, they all say the same thing. And it doesn't matter whether we are in a suburb of Columbus, Ohio, or an inner city, or the Archdiocese of LA, or the Zuni Pueblo in New Mexico. They always say the same thing. And they say their kids were collaborating. They showed empathy and compassion. They achieved at a higher level. You know, there's probably 20 things that they say that is common no matter what. And that's even the high school math teacher will say that. So how can you be more intentional about it? Building that in. If you're doing a robotics class and your kids create an automated wheelchair for a toddler who needs it, you've just added the empathy piece to an otherwise wonderful, authentic experience, but there are ways to do it. So I think part of it is showing examples, because if they say our schedule won't allow it, well, somebody's changed a schedule somewhere else that has allowed it. It's our will to make these changes. And then they're kind of, once they try it, it's so rewarding for them as well as the kids. I think that may be why we focus so much on working. We rarely come in, do a workshop, and then we're gone. We're working with schools and districts, you know, for 5-20 years to try to build that awareness. One other example I'll give you real quickly. So we have a AP calculus teachers who, after the AP test last year, wanted to go to the elementary and put on plays about circumference, which is a elementary level math related story. And so they waited until after the AP test was over to do it. And the they surveyed the kids at the end of the school year and said, what was the best thing about this year for you? And they said, going to the elementary and working with the kids. So this year, the administration gave a half day sub to work with the elementary teachers. And they planned out throughout the school year where they're going to get together. And they're creating, they looked at their curriculum and found common standards that were common at AP Calculus and third or fourth grade. So that it wasn't just, we're going to come down to a play and it was fun, but it will serve both ends of the spectrum. And the kids love it. And, but what's really important to me, you know, when another aha moment was, if an administrator will give teachers even a half day sub to plan, they can come up with the most innovative things. They just need some time. And it didn't break the bank. It didn't throw their schedule into awful. But the elementary teachers said to us in that first meeting, you know, it's around third or fourth grade where kids start saying they're not math people. And because of this, those kids at the elementary are going to say, I can't wait until I get to the high school and I can take AP Calculus. They will be math people,
right?
Or at least believe they are. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. And, you know, and I really love that example. And you've shared that one with me before, but mm-hmm. I think it's a very telling one. And I guess the other thing that I think is really interesting about that example that I would love to highlight is that, you know, it's fascinating because the learning that took place from those AP Calc kids, and AP is a whole nother story. We all know this program that I'm not a fan, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, right.
But the reality is that those high school students learned far more by taking the concepts that were important in calculus and figuring out collectively how to teach some of those similar concepts to those younger students, that the reality is they learned way more doing that exercise than I'm guaranteeing that they did when the teacher stood up and provided the same lesson to the high school students, because those students translated that knowledge. And that is such a higher level of understanding and application, right? And that is the most authentic thing we can do.
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
You're right. And I don't think in education we spend enough time, or at least across the board, mm-hmm. spend enough time reflecting on why something worked so that we can then be more intentional about creating those experiences and expand it to different areas. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can do that in AP Calculus, you can do it in ELA, or you could do it.
You can do it in everything. My goodness, why do we even need to have that conversation? And the answer is, why are we? So Ellen, let's talk about that as we get ready to wrap this up. So why are we still having to have this conversation? Why are we still so desperately in need of the Kathy and Ellen Roadshow, honestly? And there's a tremendous amount of need. But as we step back and think about the collective work that so many of us in this transformative space are doing, and it's a lot of really great stuff, you know, what is it going to take? And I've made this my mission for 2024 on this program. I'll highlight it here, because this episode will come out in 24, is to ask this question, right? So what is it that we fundamentally need at a systems level to make it possible for us to see a future where the work that we are doing is no longer necessary because it is happening everywhere?
I think we need the collective courage to define learning and achievement differently than we have traditionally and differently than state legislatures and often parent communities as a result of that have traditionally done. Now, I do believe that district leaders, especially if they don't act alone, especially if they're not the only ones, but I think it is possible to transform the viewpoint of parents and communities. I think it is possible, as Tony Wagner has said, to realize that there are more and more universities that are looking at authentic products from students versus test scores. You know, we don't have to choose to give in to the prevailing measurement of what it means to be successful and to achieve at a meaningful level. We are measuring the wrong stuff.
Yes, we are.
We are measuring the wrong stuff, but it takes a lot of people working together to convey that message and to modify the paradigm that currently governs us. And so why are we still having the conversation? Because the paradigm that governs us is still traditional. I really believe that coming out of the pandemic, there has been a greater openness to look at learning more broadly and more authentically, because we've seen what happened to the mental health of kids. We know that we're losing kids and we're losing teachers, and the consequence of not looking at learning differently is greater than the cost of making change.
And I think we can't, parents, I'm sure, are afraid, okay, if we do something differently, our kids' test scores are going to go down. They're not going to learn. And I think we have to be better as a profession at showing parents, helping parents understand that when kids learn more deeply, that if they're not learning it, they're memorizing to take a test and then 2 weeks later can't remember what it was they learned. And so,
worse down the road, they can't apply any of it.
They can't apply
it. Right, right.
And so I think that's part of it. But trying somehow, if we could wave a magic wand, it would have everybody start to look at where can we make connections on things, so that everything isn't done in a silo. So, you know, you've got every acronym that happens, you know, in schools and so forth. I know Ellen talked about the state legislature. So I think we were told the other day that teachers have to take an additional 30 hours of PD on science of reading this summer.
Right.
I think I'm right on that. So why not teach, help? I'm not opposed to teachers learning how to teach reading better, but connected to that PD ought to be is how can you teach them the skills and to read for purpose?
Correct. I agree. Yes.
And so, you know, at our Summer Institute this summer, I'd love to have at least a session or two with somebody that really understands the science of reading and the importance of once you have those skills or as you learn those skills, you're learning with purpose to do something with it versus I can read these words and answer five questions.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. There's no reason why that entire endeavor and experience mm-hmm. cannot be rooted in a very authentic, transdisciplinary, yeah. community-driven experience and opportunity for kids. Absolutely. I agree.
And if you're able to accomplish that, it will put us out of business because that may be the only way that because it's too much. Administrators and teachers are bombarded with, well, you got to teach this and you got to teach this. And where is the piece of the system that helps them make the connections of how all those things work together to what your vision for teaching and learning is in your district, in the state, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I agree. And I would argue that's where our industry partners need to come in, right? Mm-hmm. Because our industry partners, you know, are are the, what are we preparing kids for, right? You know, mm-hmm. I think one of the other fundamental questions, we don't have time for this one today, but perhaps we'll get together, ladies, and have this conversation later, good. Is really around, like, what are we preparing kids for, right? And that has to be one of those foundational and fundamental questions that we mm-hmm. have to ask as we think about the purpose of the system moving forward. But again, I digress. We're going to set that one aside because good. That's a big conversation. But
it is.
Ladies, I want to thank you so much for making time out of your day to come and have this conversation with us about authentic learning. And I also want to thank you both profusely and profoundly for the work that you do, because it is so incredibly necessary. And the conference you put on and the training and the ongoing support that you provide across the ecosystem of teaching and learners that you're working with is absolutely incredible, and we appreciate that very much.
Well, I'm sure Ellen and I both, that means so much to us, Annalise, because we have such great respect for you and the work that you do, so we appreciate you having us.
Absolutely.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you, too.
Thank you for joining us for Learning Unboxed, a conversation about teaching, learning, and the future of work. I want to thank my guests and encourage you all to be part of the conversation. Meet me on social media at Annalise Corbin and join me next time as we stand up, step back, and lean in to reimagine education.